Hello and welcome to episode 5.5 of Uncovering the Bronze Age. No fancy intro music or witty title this time, because this episode I'm taking a break from research-heavy topics and delving into the UBA mailbag. There's quite a lot to talk about. Due to the structure of episode 5, there was no real place to address the feedback I had received on the previous months. And since then, more and more thoughtful responses and insights from you guys have poured in about Seduction of the Innocent and Frederick Wortham. So let's kick things off by going all the way back to comments left on episode 1, Kryptonite Nevermore. Alexander Osias from the Philippines wrote in to say, "Hello, Emily. I happened upon your podcast via the Fire and Water Network, featuring Professor Allen, which led me to Relatively Geeky, which led me to both the Mercy-ish of Legends of the Dark Knight and Uncovering the Bronze Age. I was shocked to discover that this story, one I'd encountered through a birthday gift from my grandmother many years ago, heralded the beginning of the Bronze Age Superman. My version of this comic is in black and white, so it was nice to have some pics in color on your blog. Your accounting of the adventure brought back many good memories. In retrospect, my appreciation for the plot holes slash reality holes was really colored by a young boy's lack of familiarity with the world. In cartoons, kicking villains through metal didn't mean they were dead, and I apply the same logic here. However, I will defend Superman's eating of the Iron Stones. Even through this time period, there was a comic book logic that went something like, all Kryptonian stuff is super tough, all Earth stuff is super weak. In other words, Superman is all Kryptonian inside and out, so his digestion is super tough by default. As much as I loved the walk down memory lane, I really enjoyed your analysis of the art and storytelling. There was something about the panel-to-panel continuity, the panel composition, and the figure and background art by Kurt Swan that I really loved. It's a shame he doesn't get more love these days. Almost a year late, but just emailing to say I enjoyed the episode and will rush to download the others." Now that's probably the best thing about this show, updating this infrequently, is that even if your feedback is a year, maybe 2 years late, you're only going to be about 4 episodes behind. Thinking positive. A website commenter, Zante's Fire, left a similar note about Superman's digestive abilities, noting that in the past, Superman had swallowed massive quantities of liquids and gases that his stomach or lungs had to compress, not to mention swallowing explosives or radioactive materials. Superman's invulnerability means that eating iron rocks would be about the same as a human swallowing a sanitized ball bearing. It's not really going to hurt you. He brought up a slightly different issue, however. I read this comic years after it came out, and I already knew about the kryptonite being turned into iron thing. What bothered me was, would Superman really swallow something that used to be kryptonite? What if it was a Mr. Mxyzptlk or Lex Luthor trick? He could have ended up dying from kryptonite stomach poisoning. So Superman eating the rock seemed more like the writers just pointing out, kryptonite, it's not going to be a problem in the future. I'm glad that people liked that first Superman-centric episode, because I do still have plans at some point in the future to go back and look at some more of Kryptonite Nevermore. Zante's Fire noted that most of the kryptonite was turned to iron, and that kryptonite no longer was a problem. And we'll get into some of those questions about how effective this quote-unquote reboot of Superman with the new status quo would actually last and how effective it would be overall. Relatedly, Ed Moore from the Mighty Thor cast wrote in to say, specifically about episode 3, but also applying to episode 1, "I feel compelled to salute you on the appropriate dropping of douchebaggery into your discussion. I feel we as a society do not discuss douchebaggery as much as we should. And as I just said, I intend to look at some more Superman comics, which means more Morgan Edge, which means more douchebaggery. You're welcome, Ed." Episode 4, featuring the Super Sons of Superman and Batman, got a decent amount of feedback, starting with a letter from Gene Hendricks of The Hammer Strikes. "Emily, I just listened to the latest Uncovering the Bronze Age, and I have to say I am shocked. I am shocked that the idea of Bob Haney making Sons of Superman and Batman, who wear identical costumes and are named Clark and Bruce Jr., actually turned out to be an interesting, well-written story. You have floored me, madam. Having gotten into comics after the Bronze Age, at least in my own opinion anyway, I have tended to ignore stories from that era, but there do seem to be some gems out there, and that is why I'm grateful for your show. This way I can discover stories like this one that make me want to explore more in the era. Well done." Thank you, Gene. It's always nice to know that I'm kind of achieving my mission statement. which is to roll with the punches, acknowledge some of the silliness, but really highlight when books from the 70s are shockingly better than we remember them being. I'm not saying that the Bronze Age was the best era of comics, but is probably the most underrated just because of how often it's ignored. Ben Avery of Strangers and Aliens and the Ultraverse Network also wrote in to say, "Great episode. I can't say why, but in spite of those audio issues, I think this might have been my favorite UBA episode thus far. The Super Sons stories have always captured my imagination, in concept if not on the page. I found I had a hard time slogging through the collected edition. Like you said, there's a mix of good and bad. I feel like I need to check it out from the library again, just so I can find the story that pissed you off so much, because I'm pretty sure I didn't finish the book. And if you didn't finish the book, you did not get to the story that pissed me off so much, because it is the last full story. There's a 8-page backup or something filling the final pages of that volume, but the last story is the one that just, it almost managed to negate a lot of the positive feelings that I had related to the issue we actually discussed in episode 4. And that takes a lot, because I spent that entire episode raving about how great it was. I don't know, you might not hate it as much as me, but, yeah. It's a real punch to the feels, and not in a good way. Ben continues, "Anyway, I would love to see a modern reboot of this concept. Not as a part of an alternate New 52 future thing, but using the big idea of Batman and Superman doing an Elseworlds-style genuine tale with their kids. Anyway, thanks for the podcast. No need to apologize for not doing episodes lately. Podcasting takes time, and you do this for free. So thanks again, and keep up the great work." And thank you, Ben, for writing in. I think the reason I feel the need to apologize so often is because these episodes really don't take me that long. It's just a lot of times I don't want to sit down and record. And I feel a little bit guilty about that, knowing that I could have a monthly or at least bi-monthly schedule, but just being utterly incapable of keeping any sort of structured release format scheduled, like, it's just not going to happen. So I appreciate that you guys appreciate that I am lazy, and that's okay. The final email about episode 4 comes from Noel Thingvall, who wrote to say, "Another great episode, and well worth the wait. I've yet to cross paths with any of Bob Haney's comic work, and had never even heard of the Super Sons before, so this was all new to me. Definitely sounds like interesting stuff, and on top of my dad recently mentioning Haney as an interesting, if inconsistent, writer, you have me curious to track some of it down. Great review as always." Yeah, inconsistent is definitely the word for Bob Haney, because I've read some of his 60s stuff. In my opinion, not that good. Not that good. Again, I'm sort of ruined because I really love the Wolfman Perez Titans, but anything involving the Titans and Haney is just terrible to me. And as Ben and I discussed, the other stories in that trade range from not that good to very, very weird. There's a very specific flavor to Bob Haney stories, and I totally understand people being like, take it or leave it. But then again, if you're in a Haney mood, accept no substitutes. Noel's final comment was, "An excellent choice of closing music." Yeah, I was actually listening to his episode of I Hate Love Remakes, talking about John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13. And that song was so perfectly suited for what I thought I would be talking about in episode 5. Campy, cheesy, a little bit on the creepy edge, but just really ultra 70s. But as we all know, episode 5 ended up going a very different direction. And before we talk about that once in a lifetime, never gonna happen again, episode 5, we're gonna take a quick break, play a promo, and come back to talk even more about Frederick Wortham and Seduction of the Innocent.
Tangent, an abrupt change of course.
Tangent, to go off suddenly in another direction or on a different line of thought.
Tangent, a comic event featuring brand new characters with very familiar names.
I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals.
Parallel Lines, the DC Comics Tangent Universe podcast.
Find it bi-weekly on iTunes and at greatkrypton.com.
In the Tangent Universe, you only know the names.
Unsurprisingly, Episode 5 is the one that I have the absolute most feedback from, most number of people, and most in-depth responses. A lot of the reaction tended to be short comments of sheer awe and surprise and wonder at this pseudo-audio docudrama fully produced historical BBC something or other that I created. And let me just say, I am really glad that technically that episode came out as fantastic as it did. I would have been satisfied if it had come out half that good in just sheer quality. And then additionally, the number of people who were excited, enthralled, surprised, whatever, just generally impressed with the episode, that really means a lot, that you guys have enjoyed listening to it at least as much as I enjoyed making it. Our first two comments are from Daniel Butcher, standing in for most of the people on Facebook, who simply said, "Well done." And Kurt Green, who asked if I would get extra credit at work for stuff like this. You know, librarian style. And unfortunately, no, because I'm still waiting for the wonderful day, maybe 5-10 years in the future, where I can focus specifically on the cataloging of comic books. Recognition of comic books as a legitimate form of literature is coming, and it's coming soon. Jason Trenner, a.k.a. Fanboy and Ms. Prime, wrote in to say, "Wow, just wow, that was amazing. The only thing I felt was missing was mentioning the demise of the Comics Code with X-Force 116, but that's a mere minor side note at most. Plus, a comic I like and I think is worth discussing. Just not on this show, as it is in no way Bronze Age in the slightest. Great show, and keep up the good work." Jason Van Slyke wrote in to say, "I've been listening through the Relatively Geeky Network's back catalog, and it's been pretty great stuff. The solo shows are enjoyable, and the duo/guest shows are always fun. I came for the quarter bin and stayed for the everything, which has been a great deal of fun. Had to drop you a note to say that UBA 5 was like a level up in everything. The music tied it all together, but it was so well written. Just excellent. Words fail me." Thank you both for your kudos. Unfortunately, we're going to have to skip right ahead to the main course of this section of the podcast, which is talking about the 5 or 6 essays that I received in response to this. What I didn't realize was that I had essentially assigned everyone homework, since they felt the need to write me essays, which I must then grade. You guys do realize my dad's the one that's a professor, right? Anyway, the first of these excellent responses comes from Neil Stanifer, a.k.a. The Grammar Merchant. "Emily, I just have to say thanks. I've been waiting a long time for one of my favorite comic podcasts to touch on Wortham and his work. So long, in fact, that I guess I gave up hope. What a delight, then, to listen to your episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age, dealing with seduction of the innocent and its consequences. Great job, and kudos as well to your fellow podcasters for helping out. Full disclosure, I am currently staring at my own copy of Seduction of the Innocent, a limited edition 2004 reprint by James Reibman for Main Road Books. And that's how you know that Neil is an English teacher, ladies and gentlemen, because he feels the need to cite his comments. Then again, I put a works cited on an audio essay, so the book sat on my want list for 3 years, through several birthdays and Christmases, before I broke down and decided that my loved ones and friends thought I was trying to get them to buy me porn. So I bit the bullet and bought it for myself. Ouch. It was not cheap, but I am so glad that I bought and read it. I think you're exactly right to portray Wortham as a complex figure. He really had good intentions, I'm convinced, and I salute his work with inner-city kids. And while I don't dismiss some of his media savvy, I agree that he certainly began with his prudish and snobbish conclusion and worked backwards. Not a great scientist by any stretch, but then again, he was a Freudian. Ooh, academic burn! Before you dismiss his Batman-Robin-Man-Boy-Love equation out of hand, though, take a look at what Andy Medhurst has to say about it. A queer theorist, Medhurst draws mainly from the 66 Batman TV show, which is admittedly full-tilt boogie camp. But the seeds for that show were planted in the post-code anti-relationship Batman comics. So in a sense, while pre-code Batman could have been interpreted as gay with a squint and twist of the head, it wasn't until after the code that Batman became so anti-sexual as to foreground the Batman-Robin relationship in a girls-are-icky kind of way, which really threw open the gates to at least one type of gay reading for the characters. And Neil brings up an excellent point here. I didn't want to touch on it too much because, first of all, the episode was already running so long, and secondly, because Neil is right, there are some queer theorists who take a very specific sort of ownership of Batman as a potential gay character or a gay red character. But I did not feel comfortable lumping all queer theorists into one single group and saying that there was a unified opinion on Batman, because I found the opinions on that vary a lot from person to person, and I did not have a specific example. So thank you, Neil, for bringing up Andy Medhurst. Neil continues, as for Wonder Woman, if you haven't taken up a short study of William Moulton Marston, you might find it interesting. And I'd definitely be interested in doing that at some point, though probably not right now. Wonder Woman is one of my favorite characters, and so I would like to know a little bit more about her history and the history of her creator. And as we've already established, there is nothing that I like more than giving myself homework for my hobbies. Neil's letter continues, where the darkness seeps into the room is when Wortham begins to buy into his own hype, as you aptly pointed out. When he goes from a simple prudish snob who genuinely cares about kids to a guy who has to win all the prizes in a duel to the death, that's where Wortham crosses the literary line from hero to anti-hero, maybe even to villain. His goal wasn't to reform comics, but shut them down. Once he began to win, no measure of compromise was far enough. We were treated to precisely this behavior again during the 1980s battle of the PMRC, the Parent Music Resource Center, and abolishing questionable music. It happened again, albeit in an abortive form, when Democrat Senator Joe Lieberman tried to bring Hollywood to heel in a populist play to his ambiguous base. Hollywood pretty much showed him the finger, which is the only sane response to the censors, in my opinion. But of course it will happen again. And again. Whether it's the novel itself, pulp stories, waltzes, rock and roll, movies, comic books, video games, or whatever, there will always be somebody who has preconcluded that this new art form is at the root of children's unwillingness to fit neatly into little boxes. Anyway, enough out of me. Thanks for giving me a reason to drag out SOTI from hiding and keep bringing excellent insight to this understudied art form. Oh, and if you want horror, may I recommend Creepy and Eerie? You won't regret them. Thanks for the awesome letter, Neil. Though not an email, I wanted to shout out to Shag for recently reposting my episode 5 again and getting a few more listeners, more comments, more feedback, more discussion, which I very much appreciated. You're a cool dude. Chris and Cindy Franklin of the Supermates podcast wrote in to say, "Hi, Emily. I just want to applaud you on your excellent episode covering Dr. Wortham. Believe it or not, I actually found a copy of Seduction of the Innocent in my middle school library in 7th or 8th grade. Even then, I knew of Wortham as comics boogeyman, as you put it. I actually read the book and came to many of the same conclusions you did, although I don't think that my young mind quite comprehended the nuance that you found." This was a nice thing. Actually, a decent number of people who wrote in said that they had read Seduction of the Innocent. So I'm very glad that people are going out, not just because of my episode, but in general, going out and actually reading this piece of literature, which is so important to comics history. Chris continues, I do think Wortham had some valid concerns on the violence in comics. As much as we love the EC material today, it's honestly pretty tasteless, and probably doesn't belong in the hands of children. When he went gunning for DC's heroes, that was a bridge too far, as DC had pretty strict rules in place for their characters and had child psychologists sitting on their advisory board, even pre-code. And this was something that got brought up a decent amount in the debates over comics, and is something that a lot of people will recognize today, was questions of professional integrity. The idea that because they were on the advisory board for DC specifically, they couldn't be trusted to be impartial about the content of DC books, whereas Dr. Wortham being an outsider should be more trusted. As always, it's important to remember that just because somebody's an outsider doesn't actually make them impartial, since the people who were sitting on DC's board were probably genuinely impartial, whereas Wortham was, as aforementioned, gunning to kill the books. Wortham's attacks on Superman as a fascist icon seem especially humorous now, since everyone knows of the Jewish heritage of his creators, Siegel and Schuster. I wonder if his specific obsession with deriding Wonder Woman may have come from a kind of psychologist's rivalry with her creator, William Moulton Marsden. He was a well-respected, if slightly controversial, figure in the field at the times. There was a lot of bondage in Marsden Wonder Woman tales, but as I recall, Wortham glossed over that obvious target and went straight for the overly strong woman angle he seemed to detest, as you pointed out. This was the email that made me really want to research some William Moulton Marsden. I knew about the bondage and some of his maybe slightly confused views on women, etc., etc. But there are few things that interest me more than an academic catfight, especially between two guys as passionate and controversial as Wortham and Marsden. So I'm definitely going to have to investigate some of this in the future. The email concludes, again, great episode and great contributions from other podcasting luminaries. I'm not even sure you can call this episode a podcast, more like an audio documentary. Thanks for those insightful comments, Chris. The next email comes from Luke Giaconetti of Earth Destruction Directive, here to provide some counterpoints to my discussion. Hey there, Missy. Just wanted to drop you a quick email and give a big thumbs up for your In the Clutches of the Code episode. Kudos for doing your research and coming to your own conclusions, not just parroting the oft-repeated platitudes one can easily find online or in an old fanzine or back issue of Wizard. The production was as close to a tour de force as one could get for a nonfiction podcast as well. I also have to applaud your timing, as I have just finished reading my full run of EC's Vault of Horror, reprinted by Gemstone in the 1990s. In the closing days of EC, Bill Gaines read an editorial essentially accusing Dr. Wortham of being a self-righteous do-gooder, stirring up emotions with no basis in fact. Gaines also accused Wortham and those who think like him of not actually reading the comics they are crusading against. As such, Gaines asked his readers to send cards and letters to their congressperson and tell them what they really think of EC's product, including what their parents would comment as well. To his credit, Gaines said that he wanted readers to send in opinions both good and bad, to at least put the truth out there about their comics. Gaines, of course, made some of the most stirring comments during the Senate subcommittee hearings, including a statement which I have always loved. Jimmy Walker once remarked that he never knew a girl to be ruined by a book. No one has ever been ruined by a comic. Now, this was something I was really sad had to get cut out of the episode, that originally there was going to be a lot more discussion of the trial itself, but when I realized that the book discussion part had taken up almost 40 minutes, and I really didn't want to break 75 at the absolute limit, I knew that things had to go, and this quote was one of the things I was saddest to see go, because it also meant cutting apart, and I was going to ask Luke Giaconetti. Sorry, Luke. But I was glad that he was able to bring this and weigh in anyway after the fact. Some of the discussions after the episode came out, people talked about how unfortunate it was the way that William Gaines ended up presenting himself at the subcommittee. But when I read the transcripts, I was actually rather impressed. And though maybe his arguments may not have been entirely compelling, Luke's right that he has some of the best zingers that I've ever read in a court case. Not that you get terribly many of those most of the time. So thanks to Luke for writing in general, but mega thanks for bringing this particular part of the discussion up so that I actually had a chance to talk about it. He continues, My own opinions of Dr. Wortham and his actions against the comics medium are deeply rooted and unlikely to change. I agree with Gaines' description of him as a do-gooder, or to borrow a phrase from Ned Flanders, the answer to a question no one asked. To me, it doesn't matter how noble his intentions were. He still thought he was the smartest man in the room, and thus able to pass judgment on everyone else. And his actions also enabled Atlas and DC to essentially force EC out of comics. Convenient for them, since EC's genre books were outstripping Atlas's tame monster, western, and romance output, as well as DC's white-bread pre-showcase number 4 superheroes. Wortham's actions started the death of the comic book genre, with really only war comics thriving through the silver and hanging on into the Bronze Age. As a lifelong horror fan who's had to put up with such unelected do-gooders insisting that we know better than you when it comes to genre content, I cannot stomach a technocrat using shoddy techniques to impugn what I choose to consume. Luke is absolutely right, and again, partially because I wanted to be fair and impartial as much as I could be in the discussion of the book, I tried to keep my own opinion somewhat in the background, but I absolutely agree. Well, unlike Luke, since I'm not a strong horror fan or monster fan or anything of that nature, I haven't had to deal with this sort of bias of, oh, you like that thing, ergo you must be disturbed, confused, scary. But I've had to deal with enough people assuming that what I'm consuming is inappropriate, wrong, people who like to pass judgment on a medium or a genre without experiencing it or trying to understand it. I sometimes like to say, everyone's entitled to an opinion, but ignorance is a choice. If you can't be bothered to go and create an informed opinion, I don't feel any sort of obligation to listen to you. Like Neil brought up earlier, these are the same sorts of battles that we've been fighting over music, video games, anime. I mean, I was young, but I remember when people were talking about boycotting Power Rangers because it was clearly going to teach kids to be violent and go out and, I don't know, fight monsters, make sparks shoot out of their chests. I don't know. This also ties into a point that I made originally in a little bit more depth. A lot of it had to get cut out for the final edit. But it really frustrates me when people treat children like idiots and treat adults like children. A lot of the debates over the code and whether or not it would count as censorship has to do with questions of audience appropriateness and expected readership. I mean, they assumed that most of the readers were kids, and that's a fine assumption to make. That's who they were sort of primarily targeting at least some of these books towards. What would have been ideal, probably, would be to institute something that's more like a mature reader's label. But that didn't happen. Instead, all comics got reduced to what would be acceptable for an 8-year-old to read. It's hardly a controversial opinion, but I think by the time you're 18, you're allowed to consume what you want. You know, your parents can still offer advice, and people can suggest yes or no, or are you sure you want to partake in that particular type of entertainment? But really, it's not their business, and you're under no obligation to listen to them. If you want to watch R-rated movies, sure. If you want to watch kids' cartoons, nobody's business. They don't get to tell you what you get to enjoy. Before the age of 18, there maybe should be some guidelines or suggestions that are offered. But in my opinion, once you're 12 to 14, you can actually make a lot of complex decisions on your own that a lot of people don't give kids the credit for being able to do. It's something that's happening now with kids' cartoons, or I should say cartoons that are marketed and aimed towards children, but have really deep or dark, crazy, dark, complex stories, backgrounds, morals that they deal with. And the wonderful thing about these shows, I'm thinking specifically of things like Adventure Time or Gravity Falls, is that kids love them. And adults love them because it's good art. And I think that's the saddest thing about the comics code, is that in a way it stifled so much of the creativity and the inventiveness and the strangeness of comics and made it so sanitary for quite a long time. Now, as I brought up in the episode, that eventually gave us the backlash, which gave us the modern comics industry. But it's times like this that I wish I had some sort of TARDIS or dimensional travel device, and I could go to the parallel universe where this didn't happen, where EC Comics had continued to make engaging, gripping, kind of scary, thought-provoking stories for decades later, and just see how the comics medium would have changed. Maybe we would have gotten something like Sandman 15 or 20 years earlier. Though, to be fair, Sandman coming out in the 70s, whew, that would have been trippy. Luke's email continues, considering Dr. Wortham's particular revulsion for violence against human eyes, as well as violence against women, I wonder what he would have made of the Italian horror maestro Lucio Fulci. Fulci's films often include carnage aimed at the eyes, including the famous scene from Zombie 2, a.k.a. Zombie, a.k.a. about 12 dozen other titles, where a woman's face is slowly pushed towards a giant splintered shard in a door until, well, you get the idea. Oddly, at the end of his career, Fulci made a film challenging some of Wortham's statements. A Cat in the Brain, a.k.a. Nightmare Concert, is sort of a meta-film, which Fulci essentially plays himself, a director of gory horror films, and addresses the idea of violent imagery driving the viewer to violence. This is probably the single best thing that came out of the whole Seduction of the Innocents, Code, Wortham event, was down the line comics creators creating comics addressing these concepts. I'm a big fan of Linkara and the show Atop the Fourth Wall, and every year for Halloween, he does a bunch of short daily reviews of various horror comics. And at least once, maybe two or three times, he's pulled comics that dealt with this idea of a psychologist writing a book about the evils of comics. And in some cases, it deals with a horror host or the in-world realities of those horror characters. The Witch from The Witching Hour, Cain and Abel, The Crypt Keeper, all of those sorts of characters, and the way that public opinion affects them in the stories. These sort of meta-tales, sort of like this film that Luke mentions. I'm a big sucker for art about art, and controversial art against the controversy of the art is just navel-gazy enough that I'm really fascinated by it. I've already mentioned that I'm not a big horror person, but I might check out a little bit of Lucio Fulci, maybe, next Halloween. Luke wraps up with, in any idea, thank you for your incredibly insightful look at Seduction of the Innocent and Dr. Wortham's actions and legacy. And what a hell of a legacy it was. So thank you very much for writing in, Luke. I really appreciated your counterpoints, especially your experience as a lifelong horror and monster fan who's had to deal with this kind of BS your whole life. It had been a little while since I had an epic Luke Giaconetti original crafted response essay sent in, and I was starting to miss them a little bit. But we are not done yet. Mark Adams of Mark's Mess sent in this email. Emily, I didn't know what would be happening with this episode, and I was presented with what I could only assume was the start of a university diploma course. So I only have one question. Where do I sign up? It really was a treat. I was expecting an examination of a simple comic, but the analysis of the comics code was informative and presented in an entertaining way. This is one episode that I will listen to a few more times. Not only the way the subject was handled made this a great podcast, but the production values were top-notch. This could have been a BBC radio documentary. The other voices were an added bonus and well integrated into the body of the work. This is the type of stuff that makes mine look like fluff. Don't get me wrong, we need fluff, but we also need the solid analysis that you've brought. Great work. Thank you very much, Mark. I don't want to go on too long patting myself on the back for this audio accomplishment, but it was a serious undertaking to get this podcast put together, and I am so insanely happy that it came out with such empirical good quality. Just the sound effects and the timing and the music all worked really well and came out almost as good as I had envisioned it in my head in my best possible perfect scenario, and the fact that everyone else has really enjoyed it and appreciated the, seriously, like 2 weeks of editing that went into this thing, just, it means a lot, guys. And our final email comes from Tom Panarese of Pop Culture Affidavit. He writes, Emily, I recently listened to your episode about Frederick Wortham and Seduction of the Innocent, and had to write in and mention that I thought it was amazing. I've never read all of Seduction, though I did skim it in places when I found a copy at my college library, but didn't check it out because my schedule was way too packed for me to read it. By which I mean there was Mortal Kombat Trilogy to play, after all. So, like most comic fans, my knowledge of Wortham comes through books about him and his book. Your discussion and analysis of the book really brought a new perspective to the man and his work, and was also one of the best looks I've ever seen or heard on the topic. You were able to humanize him and also provide the type of thorough look at that period of comic book history that seems to be increasingly rare in our culture when it comes to history in general. Too many people want heroes, villains, and clear-cut stories when actual history, much like reality, is incredibly messy. So in short, loved it, loved it, loved it. And I'm looking forward to the next episode. I really appreciate the kind words, Tom. That point that you made at the end about heroes and villains in history really is sort of a personal soapbox of my own. Now, I got my degree in sociology, but a real strong passion of mine is history. As you point out, history is happening all around us, all the time. And in reality, we don't tend to have snidely whiplash, mustache-twirling villains, or perfect paragons of humanity. We're just people. And that's what I really wanted to bring to this analysis, was that then Frederick Wortham was just a person, doing the best that he could, and royally screwing things up along the way. Thank you all for writing in, and for Shag reposting the episode, and people sharing it and discussing it, and all sorts of things. You guys are all awesome. I was glad that I was able to create this episode for you guys, and I am doubly glad that you guys got so much out of it and had so much more to tell me. This is why I love doing these sorts of things, the ability to have a conversation about things that we all love, something that doesn't happen often enough. Anyways, this brings us to the end of the mailbag and the end of our 5.5 episode mailbag extravaganza special. I'll be back, hopefully not too much later, with a brand new episode discussing another comic from the 70s. So until next time, catch you later. But for me, I didn't feel that that was... Oh, Mom's home.
Hello.
Hello!
Are you podcasting?
I was.